It's the end of the week, so we're doing the nose. Although there's sort of a question about whether this is really a version of the nose, which is our weekly cultural roundtable where a panel gets together and kicks some cultural issues around. We decided we needed to focus on Hamilton. Hamilton is in Connecticut for 3 weeks of performances right now. Obviously, it is really in its own category in terms of popular culture of the 21st century. I don't even really know what I would compare it to. So we decided to get together some people who really know about Hamilton, who've seen Hamilton in some cases more than once, who want to analyze its music. We also have a first-timer, somebody seeing it for the first time. This is a show for people who don't like musicals, who don't like live theater, who don't like rap. It has all of those things in it. Somehow or other, everybody feels as though they need to be at it. So we'll talk about why after the news.
How does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar?
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter by 14. They placed him in charge of a trading charter.
And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves, he struggled and kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, or barter.
Then a hurricane came and devastation rained. Our man saw his future drip, dripping down the drain. Put a pencil to his temple, connected it to his brain, and he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain.
Well, the word got around, they said this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came, and the world's gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton, and there's a million things I haven't done. But just you wait, just you wait.
So let me tell you what we're doing today. It's our regular Friday show. Ordinarily, we take a bunch of topics from culture and kick them around. We call it the nose. This week, because the show Hamilton has opened a run in Hartford, it's playing here for the benefit of Connecticut people for 3 weeks. We decided to focus on that. Let me tell you who's here in the studio. Rich Holland is a principal and design director at CoLab and a commissioner on cultural affairs for the city of Hartford. Steve Metcalf is director of University of Hartford's President's College. Virginia Woolf, no, not that Virginia Woolf, is a local actress and audiobook, or maybe it is, audiobook narrator and the founder of Her Story Theater. All right, so I think we first maybe have to begin by explaining who everybody is here in addition to their titles in terms of their relationship to the show. And so I'm going to start over you over here with you, Virginia Woolf. Tell us about you and the musical Hamilton.
Well, the first time I saw Hamilton was kind of by mistake. A friend said, "Oh, we have to go into New York. We have to see Lin-Manuel's latest." And I was like, "Okay, sure, whatever." So Valentine's Day, 2015, we went in. It was a stormy Saturday. Driving was horrible. And I said to her, "Deb, this had better be good because I'm spending Valentine's Day with you and not my husband." We went to the matinee and...
So this was at the Public, we should say.
At the Public,
yeah, this is before Broadway.
Before Broadway, actually before they even knew they were going to Broadway. And it opened with what we just heard, and my jaw dropped, and I didn't pick it up till the end of the show.
And since then, you've seen it two more times?
Yeah.
Three more times?
I've seen it three more times. I saw it in Chicago. I have a friend who sits on the Jeff Committee out there, and there were tickets available, so I saw it there. My daughter and I, when it got announced it would be coming to Boston, we bought subscriptions so we could get the tickets there, and then it came here to Hartford.
All right. So... She's ahead of the rest of us in terms of live performance.
I don't know about
that. We might be ahead of her in terms of geeking out on the soundtrack. We'll see. Mr. Metcalf, you're the only one among us who's actually seen the show on Broadway, right?
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, I think so.
Ah, well, that's a great honor. I must say my original connection to the show, my connections to a lot of pop culture come about these days, was from my oldest daughter, Audie, who I think a day or two after the album came out called me and said, "Dad, you have to listen to this because you're not going to believe it." And you know, a sensitive dad that I am, I said, yeah, right, okay, and and sort of forgot about it for a few days. But then I actually did buy the album and listen to it, and I didn't believe it. And I was sort of instantly hooked in a way that really I'm not that often these days. And I had some acquaintance with In the Heights from the recording, and I knew of Lin-Manuel's genius. But truly, it wasn't until we went to see the show, which is now, what, about a year and a half ago. And, of course, I was thinking to myself, well, this thing can't possibly live up to the hype that it's getting. And, of course, it not only does but exceeds it. And so that's my story. I'm just like everybody else, I'm just captivated by this thing.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
Right.
All right. Rich, how about you?
So I am naturally a skeptic of all things that reach phenomenal levels, and so I've avoided this show like the plague. Mm-hmm. And but I caught little bits and pieces of it, little bits of the performances live, and some charity performances and stuff like that, and always sounded phenomenal. But I still maintain the sort of, this is too big for me. Thing is going to be at the scale of Lemmy's, and as entertaining as that is, I'm not ready for Lamborghinis and helicopters on a stage yet. And I ended up being one of 600 people so far who watched this sneak bootleg that someone made on YouTube, where they clearly brought their iPhone in there, and you could tell whenever one of the ushers was walking by, they drop it under the seat. So you only caught about a third of the show that way. And it looked really phenomenal, but I was missing the other two thirds. So this was my first time seeing the whole thing through. And blown away. I'm trying to steal some tickets.
So I have to say that, for a long time, I'm somebody who really, really enjoys theater, as do a lot of the people in this room. I see a lot of theater. The whole idea of this play that was so good that I couldn't get tickets to used to drive me out of my mind, and I wound up kind of resenting the musical. It was sort of also one of those musicals. It was the only musical or the only play a lot of people would go see for a year or two. And then they go, have you seen Hamilton? And I go, no, I saw like 27 other plays this year. Did you see any other plays except Hamilton? But when the soundtrack, when the cast album became available, I just, as was the case with Steve, I mean, I just couldn't stop listening to it. I mean, over and over again, it is such an incredible accomplishment. And so it was a thrill to see it finally here in Hartford on Wednesday night when many of us were there. So I want to just talk about, this has had an odd ascendance. And Steve, I think I'm going to start with you. I want to hear everybody on this. This play, whatever it is, whatever it winds up being, it's going to be in the pantheon, a very small group of five or six definitive American musicals. And it is a hit like no musical has been a hit in modernity. It might be a bigger hit in some ways than anything ever has. It's now become a thing that is absolutely essential to people to go see. And yet, it's because tickets are limited, and also because there's no hit song in the musical, which is really unusual for this. It's kind of hard to figure out, how did this happen? How did we get to the point where this is an essential piece of popular culture? You start with your theory.
Okay. Well, let me try to answer your first question about the no hit song thing first, because I think it's relatively important. To my mind, the reason there's no big hit tune to this show is essentially because Lin-Manuel decided not to write one or even try to write one. And when you think about it, I mean, that sounds sort of counterintuitive about trying to put together a hit show. But I think if you think about the nature of this show and the way that we all readily are willing to talk about it as a work of art, I think really if there were to be one, I dreamed a dream or some kind of cheesy moment like that, we would have a very different thought about this work. And I think that it was very wise of Miranda not to attempt one. I mean, it's certainly not to say that he couldn't have written a good one, because obviously he has the chops to do that. But I think one of the things that distinguishes this show is that all of the songs, of which there are, 43 or something, are written in the service of the storyline in a way that is just absolutely indispensable from the story itself. And there's no effort to create a tune that, you know, that Celine Dion can work into her cabaret act or whatever. And I think that's an important point to make. And I think it really does speak to the artistic integrity of the thing.
I don't know. Ginny, do you have a theory?
Well, I do agree. I think each of the songs is so stands on its own as a story in itself. Mm-hmm. That and each one moves the story forward and gives you some history. So as much as it might be beautiful, standing on its own, you wouldn't be able to – it doesn't have the context unless you know the whole story.
Well, I think what you guys are saying is significant too, because one reason when people say – and people say this to me a lot. I don't like musicals. I don't like them. I don't like musicals. And I think one of the things they don't like is the notion that people are talking for a while and then they start singing. And then they are going back to talking and then they start singing. That seems weird to them. So, Rich, in this – that essentially doesn't happen for all the reasons that Virginia and Steve are talking about right now, because the show is essentially sung through.
Exactly. It's operatic and it's also – so the music exists in themes, right? So so there's a theme that's planted at the beginning that just echoes in the middle and changes a little bit and then changes a little bit at the close and the punch. And if you string those themes together, it almost feels like you're listening to this compilation of a massive hit album because the hooks are powerful. They're gripping. I'm not taken away. I'm not throwing away my shot. You know that. Mm. You know that kind of crystal clear tempo and cadence and memorability, and yet it doesn't last 3 minutes. Mm. So it's not going to get airplay. And so it's a tremendously memorable piece as a whole. Without any 1 3-minute worth of memorability. There's a song that I particularly like a lot that you start getting into what's going to be a 3-minute piece, and you get 1 minute into it and they do a complete chorus shift, you know, and eventually follow some of the themes and the echoes of that and round it out again. But it doesn't give you that thing that's familiar.
Right. And if I could quickly follow up on that for 1 second, I think you don't. There are a number of things that you don't quite appreciate about this show from just listening to the album. And one of them is that although, as I think we all seem to agree, there aren't any standalone, you know, hit tunes, it doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't some show-stopping numbers. In fact, there are quite a few of them, some of which you might not have predicted from listening to the album. But the show does stop a number of times. And in fact, I don't think I've ever seen a show where the music director had such an important task of restarting the show long before the applause even started to die down, much less stop, or else it would be a 4-hour show.
Yeah.
But I mean, it really was a revelation to see how some of those tunes, which are so specific to the story, were nevertheless, you know, brought the house down.
And I wonder if that varies, too. You've seen multiple performances.
Yes.
Does it vary which songs are the showstoppers, are the get the audience?
I think that the way they've cast each of the companies that I've seen, they know which ones are. Mm, yeah. I think it's universal.
One other piece to answer your question, Colin, is it's this idea of having these little quick sound bites that are resonant. I think it's one of the main successes of the show, and it adapts to how a musical and how an idea is promoted right now. It gives you these perfect little micro sound bites that are shareable, that are clippable, and in that way, it's very aware of what it needs to do to promote itself.
I want to also just quickly say that one of my theories about this, I think a lot of things had to come together to produce this phenomenon of a musical which people – it's also the highest selling cast album in the history of cast albums. It has every possible superlative. I do think that one of the things that's important about this is that it's The way that it uses rap and the idioms of hip-hop is an invitation to a group of people who may have thought that maybe musicals didn't have much to offer them, you know. And I think for some of the suburban audience going to this show, they're going, oh, I didn't really think I liked rap, but I really like this. This is really good, the way it kind of advances the action, you know. And then there's a whole other generation of people who are going, oh, well, that was a – I mean, if you like hip-hop and you see you hear a song called Ten Dual Commandments, you know that that's based – that's sort of a nod to Biggie and Ten Crack Commandments. There's like a lot of stuff like that where if you're a hip-hop fan, you have a completely different relationship with this. But, you know, I mean, Ginny, in terms of audience building and stuff like that, it seems to me this is one of the things that they've done a remarkable job with is say, hey – no, there's a lot. I did a hey, which is also a convention from the show. Hey, there's something for you here.
Yeah. I think that's true. I'm not a rap hip hop. I know nothing about it, and I won't say I hate it, but I just don't experience it at all. To me, it's the storytelling. It is the perfect vehicle for the storytelling, which opens my appreciation to the fact that probably a lot of rap and hip hop out there is, but I didn't ever know that. It was just music that didn't apply to me. So I think that, yeah, brings in a generation of kids. And, I mean, even singing along, my daughter, she's got the whole cadence. She can sing the whole thing straight through. Mm-hmm. And my mouth doesn't work that fast.
Well, the Lafayette parts are pretty hard. Yeah.
Yes.
And isn't it worth noting, I think, here that at least in everything that I've read over the last, you know, several years now about this thing, seems to confirm that the hip-hop community and the rap community – which I think guards its own integrity pretty carefully, seems to acknowledge that Lin is the real thing. That he's not just this Broadway guy who thought it would be cool to try to graft that onto a show. I mean that they recognize that this guy is one of them, and I think that was important in the whole sort of cultural acceptance piece of this work.
Mm-hmm. But I'm gonna. To add to that, as important as I think that is, his acceptance that he wasn't rejected by the culture, right? It's also pretty much hip hop light, right? It's crossover hip hop, and in a lot of ways, it's like Lionel Richie singing "Stuck on You." You know, it's meant to be accessible to a broad range of people, and the language is. Is familiar to everybody. They're not using terminology that's going to leave a lot of folks scratching their heads. And there's a kind of clarity to the narrative that you could follow in a way that that rap and hip hop has got a lot of insider information about it.
But there's a fair amount there too. I mean, you know, once again, when he spells out his name, that's kind of a Biggie nod. There's the moment in the ballad "Helpless." There's a moment when Lin-Manuel Miranda plays this role, he does this thing where he drops his voice and goes, "As long as I'm alive, I say you know you never feel." And that's actually a very deliberate Ja Rule quote. Mm-hmm. It's from one of the duets that Ja Rule does. You know, even like little things like "You spit while I sit, we'll see where you land," or whatever that line is. You know, there's a lot there that I think is very much a cue to he's a fan, and he's a fan who now, as Steve says, is also very now acknowledged as a very legitimate practitioner of it. Yeah. I don't know if I would go with the hip hop light. I mean, it's not Nas. I get that, but you know, but it seems like something that is legitimately hip hop anyway, and not you know
absolutely. I think it's legitimately hip hop, but I don't think it's the hip hop that people who say I don't like hip hop are not liking.
You've now picked up my character.
I did, and it's particularly suburban.
All right, so what we'll do here is we're going to take a little break here just to do a little bit of a pledge drive. It's the last day of our pledge drive. When we come back, we're going to get a little bit deeper into the music of this show and a little bit more about the appeal of it. I should say that some of what you're about to hear, it's something that we recorded a few days ago because I think you should hear during pledge break from the people who make the show. So all the people who make our show are on this. Now, we didn't know what kind of day Friday was going to be. We didn't even know we were going to do a show about Hamilton. So we may be describing our mission a little bit differently than what you're hearing on the show. But we do ask you, it's the last day of the pledge drive. Last day, please consider supporting this show in particular. ¶¶ You're listening to The Nose, but this isn't The Nose. This is just a little break in the show that we are doing. You know, it's Pledge Week. We're asking you to support the station by calling 1-800-584-2788. Make a pledge that way or go online to WNPR.org/donate. When you do that, it really helps the programming that you hear. So this is a show that we kind of invented many, many years ago now. And once again, I think it was a case where I just came in stomping and red-faced and saying, I don't want to do the old kind of show anymore. So, but I don't know. It's kind of hard to describe what The Nose actually is. So let's ask the guy who produces it every week now, Jonathan McNichol.
It is the bane of my existence. No, I don't mean that. The thing about The Nose, the thing that's weird, and I think we talk about this sometimes, about The Nose, is we've kind of flipped the public radio model on its head. We book the guests on The Nose in advance, these wonderful, smart, funny, articulate people who are not necessarily experts in any of the things that we're going to talk about, because we don't know what any of the things we're going to talk about are when we book them. So we've got these three people in the room, and the week goes by, and Jessica Simpson does some ridiculous thing, and they're stuck talking about it on the radio. And that's the thing, is they're smart enough and quick enough and funny enough to make radio out of it.
And I think she's doing pretty well as Secretary of Transportation, too. So, you know, I think people kind of underrated her. So, yeah, one of the things that comes people who aren't used to talking on the radio come in here, and they appear on The Nose. And then so it's sort of like this fun break where a lot of Scott Breedy's in here. Carlos Mejia is in here. Golden Globe-nominated filmmaker Carlos Mejia. Betsy Kaplan's in here. And Carlos, he's just starting to talk on the radio for the first time. And what are you doing? You're complaining about how bad the microphone smells?
So I'm normally never – behind a microphone. This mic smells pretty bad. It smells like coffee breath. I don't know if that's a thing for it. Maybe you guys just gave me this mic.
No, they all smell bad. Oh, but you know what that is? That's humanity. That mic smells like humanity.
A lot of
Colin, hey, speaking of smells, I get when I'm out and about, people ask me, why is this called The Nose?
All right, so
that's a good question.
There isn't a really easy answer to that question.
Redacted. We should bleep this whole part.
Should we not explain it at all?
Is there even an answer?
Just let him talk. We'll find out.
No, let them talk.
He talks too much. Remember, that's what the survey
said. That's what the survey
says. So some people said that they thought it was The Nose, as in KNOWS, as opposed to The Nose, NOSE. So people may have just misunderstood the entire time. So now you can speak.
Well, now another thing that happened when we surveyed our listeners. Our listeners also thought that these are my friends, that I just have my friends in and we talk. I want to tell you, all the panelists hate my guts, all right? They're not friends.
They do it for Betsy. They do it for pants.
Yeah, but they get up and leave without saying a word when the show is over. I mean, it's not like we go out for coffee or anything like that.
We pay them when they leave.
Right. But yeah, I think it was sort of an opportunity to do something spontaneous, you know, and to maybe use people a slightly different way and make it about sort of the end of the week and talking around the water cooler or the coffee machine or something like that.
This doesn't explain the name of it, though.
Oh, the name.
Oh, that was the question, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. But don't. I don't think we should.
I think we should make Scott Breedy explain what the way it's
perfect.
Oh, my God.
Scott's kind of new here, so like we make him do all
you're
kinds of things
me
like that.
I have a theory when you're done.
I have no theory.
All right.
Well, take a guess anyways.
And while he's guessing, let me give out the number.
You sniff out what people are talking
about.
That's
what I was going to say. That's my theory.
Or people pick their favorite things that they want to
talk
about.
Oh. I like that better.
All right. So 1-800-584-2788, especially if you enjoy wit of that kind. 1-800-584-2788. People talking, complaining about stinky microphones. And also go online. You can make a donation at WNPR.org. That's WNPR.org. I feel like maybe I shouldn't explain it.
No,
I think that's like, you know.
That's the power. That's the power of pants. Do you do everything pants says? Yeah.
Yeah. Pants, by the way, is Jonathan McNichol. We should explain that, too.
Oh, yeah. Why do people
good.
Call you
Let's
Pants?
Explain that.
We have somebody named Pants who produces The Nose.
Why do people call you Pants?
This is sort of why we don't pull the curtain back that often. Because like, what you see doesn't really make any sense.
He's having a child who he's going to name Shorts.
Oh, wow.
That is true. There's going to be a new Pants,
not
a new Jonathan McNichol.
Pants, why do they call you Pants? We have 30 seconds.
There's no answer to this question either because it's my Twitter handle, McNichol Pants, because pants are funny. I don't know. It's Colin's fault.
You also have a domain by that name. Yeah. This is big stuff.
Online domain.
No,
yeah.
There's a lot of mystery. Maybe that's it. There's
incorrect,
a mystery.
Wrap it up, Wolfie. Wrap it up for us.
All right. Well, if you go to WNPR.org/donate, you can see all the cool stuff you can get, like my voice on your voicemail, or I'll do a motivational wake up message and telling you how awesome you are and what a great day you're going to have. But either way, please give us a call at 1-800-584-2788 and support this awesome show. It's a one of a kind. Thank you so much.
Can we get back to politics?
Please.
Yo. Every action has its equal opposite reaction. John Adams hashed the bed. I love the guy, but he's in traction. Poor Alexander Hamilton, he is missing in action. So now I'm facing Aaron Burr with his own faction.
He's very attractive in the North. New Yorkers like his chances.
He's not very forthcoming on any particular stances.
Ask him a question, it glances off. He obfuscates, he dances.
And they say I'm a Francophile. At least they know I know where France is.
Thomas, that's the problem.
All right, we're back. We are talking about the musical Hamilton. What else is there to talk about, at least in Hartford these days? Rich Holland is principal and design director at CoLab and a commissioner on cultural affairs for the city of Hartford. Steve Metcalf is our resident musicologist and director of the University of Hartford's President's College. Virginia Woolf is a local actress and audiobook narrator and the founder of Her Story Theater. Am I saying that right? Her Story?
You like, are, yes.
I'm doing my best.
You're doing great.
I can only do my best. So before we get into a little bit of like maybe geeking out on the music, one question that I asked all of you on as we were emailing back and forth about this is, you know, one experience that I have about listening to the cast album is if I'm listening to the cast album, I don't want to listen to anything else. There's nothing else that really fits in with it. And if I'm not listening to the cast album and listening to a lot of other stuff, I have to make a very specific transition to this set of music, this sensibility, the spell that is cast by this material. And I find myself wondering, partly for that reason, Virginia, whether the popularity of this is transferable. For example, the Bushnell, where it's playing right now, has experienced this huge spike in their Broadway series subscriptions, partly because that's one of the ways that you could get tickets is do a couple of years of that. There's some interesting stuff coming in, but it's not Hamilton. I just sort of wonder, you know, is this like a one-off in terms of the kind of appeal that it has, or does it bring people back maybe or introduce people to a form they just never had a particular interest in or never felt drawn toward?
I would like to think that as people come to see Hamilton, they say, oh, this the Bushnell's great, musical theater's great, it's wonderful, I'm going to become a subscriber. I don't really think that's – I think it is a phenomenon. I think as much as I love every aspect of the show, plenty of people, oh, I don't like rap, but you have to see Hamilton. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, this, that. I don't like musicals, but I had to see Hamilton. You know, I don't know – how many opportunities it's going to open aside from, and I say, up-and-coming talent and writers and all of that, seeing the doors that have been blown wide apart creatively and how you can take such a huge chance as he did and become a phenomenon. And
right.
I think that's amazing.
I mean, the elevator pitch for this is crazy, right? I'm going to do a musical about Alexander Hamilton. It's going to explain some of the foundation of the central banking system, and it's going to be hip-hop. I mean, I, you know, how you even got that produced. I don't know. What do you think, Metcalf?
Well, it sort of reminds me of the question that people asked when the three tenors was a big phenomenon, you know, and like the question then, of course, was would the three tenors produce a whole new generation of, you know, audience for opera? And I think the answer has come back, and the answer is no, it didn't, because that was a kind of one-of-a-kind, one-off thing. I guess I feel like the interesting question about Hamilton, is it going to pave the way for generally a much wider definition of what a Broadway musical can be and what kinds of people, you know, can plausibly attempt a Broadway musical and what kind of topics, you know, might be suitable. A musical about the formation of, you know, the central banking system would seem to suggest that almost anything is in play now as a subject. And I think if that's the result, as it may well be, and I think maybe we're even already seeing that a little bit with like The Band's Visit and some other shows, that will be a really historic kind of turning point. And I think there's maybe reason to think that will happen.
What do you think?
So I think that if they pitch this as a rap exploration of the creation of the national banking system, they did a really lousy job pitching this movie, pitching this play, right?
No, that was me making it an uphill climb.
All right. So I think that what's happening is that the one-off is becoming its own genre, that we're living in a culture where we're rapid prototyping things, and there's a whole bunch of ability to be exposed at an incredibly fast rate to all of what's going on globally. that it is inevitable that that these wonderful accidents of things slamming together to create something new, that peanut butter and chocolate thing, whatever that commercial was, that we're going to continue to perpetuate these one-offs that can't be replicated mm-hmm. other than to create more room for acceptance for the stuff that we haven't seen before actually being feasible and sustainable.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the music. Before we're going to plunge deeply into one of them. But I think before we do that, first of all, I've been instructed by people who do not understand my relationship with Steve Metcalf and therefore think I can make him do things to make him stop clicking his pen. But yeah, they want you to stop clicking your pen. They're upset about that. But actually, before we go deep into one song with Metcalf, let's hear Rich's favorite song. This is so Wolfie, you'll find this clip as Wait For It, I think.
Theodosia writes me a letter every day. I'm keeping her bed warm while her husband is away. He's on the British side in Georgia. He's trying to keep the colonies in line. Well, he can keep all of Georgia. Theodosia, she's mine. Love doesn't discriminate between the sinners and the saints. It takes and it takes and it takes, and we keep loving anyway. We laugh and we cry.
So this is one of the things you don't get when you go to see the Bushnell. You don't get Leslie Odom singing this particular song. Although the guy who plays Burr, I think, is very riveting in his own way. Has his own understanding of who Burr is. But one point that you argued as we were emailing around is there really are two very important stories being told on parallel tracks here.
Yeah, so it's the Aaron Burr story and the A.M. Alexander Hamilton story, and throughout this production, we're diminishing Burr, right? Mm-hmm. To a certain extent, he self-deprecates a lot. You know, he insists that that the universe needs to be paced and considered and restrained, In a show that's full of male bravado, as this one is, you know, where before introducing themselves, you know, you have to leap off a table or something, you know, that Burr was this constant, like the grown up in the room in a lot of ways. And to finally get to this one piece where you share where he's coming from and you know, and what honor of heritage and legacy really looks like, was phenomenal. And to see a black person singing it for me, you know, I forgot that it was Aaron Burr. I saw someone singing to, you know, all of black history and that sense of honor of mothers and fathers. And but the central the theme in this, I can't even call it a chorus. So the theme in this is this idea that either love or death is the sort of great equalizers of the sinners and the saints, is a thing, is an idea that gets transferred back and forth throughout this play, looking to be resolved, looking to see if you could ever pin down in this play who the sinner is and who the saint is. And those roles keep getting traded back and forth to the point that, to me, at the end of it, it doesn't matter any longer. You know, that his core premise was actually pretty accurate, that it's sort of immaterial. It's love and it's death and it's moving on.
That's a great analysis. So before we get to Metcalf's thing, Virginia, I noticed at the Bushnell, and I don't know what it's like in other places, and it's so much of this is also, there's just no getting away from the fact that most of the story of this musical has unfolded in 2016, 2017, 2018. Yeah. And so there's a song in the show where George Washington sings about one last time, and he wants his farewell address written by Alexander. They want to do it. He wants them to do it together. He talks about restraint and the notion of handing over power, and there's just sort of a dignity. Again, this is sung by a black man. Mm-hmm. And at least at the Bushnell on Wednesday night, that was the thing that I thought stopped the show almost more than anything else. It's a big number, I think,
yes.
Particularly at this moment.
Yes. And it's a poignant number as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the leader of the country is deciding to step down. We could, you know, draw parallels to all sorts of things for forever and ever with current politics. But and I think everybody's so invested in him, and the fact that George Washington, we're seeing George Washington in person on that stage. You don't think what color he is. It doesn't matter. It's, you know, our first president. And he's making decisions for the best for this country. And the only way he can do it is step down so that others can come, which I think is a riot. Then King George is like, I didn't even know you could do that.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about – so, Metcalf, you had a particular song you wanted us to spend a little bit of time with. And although our time is pressed, we're going to do the best that we can. This is a song called The Room Where It Happens. Do you want us to play the first chorus first and then
Yeah, let's have that first clip and then I can pontificate for a moment.
All right, you're going to play Ode 2, Wolfie.
Hamilton.
I'm sorry, Burr, I gotta go.
But
decisions are happening over dinner.
Two Virginians and an immigrant walk into a room.
Diametrically opposed foes.
They emerge with a compromise, having opened doors that were
previously closed. Bros.
The immigrant emerges with unprecedented financial power, a system he can shape however he wants. The Virginians emerge with the nation's capital. And here's the pièce de résistance. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade.
All right, go.
So, very quickly, I mean, it's just such a remarkable song in so many ways. But, you know, you have, for example, you have, on the one hand, the rise of Hamilton himself as a negotiator and as a power broker in the Young Republic. Secondly, you have in this song, amazingly enough, a quick explainer of the Compromise of 1790, which is not a topic that has been dealt with widely in popular music, but a very clever and sort of concise summary of that event. And then most of all, you have, as I would argue, as a sort of a sequel to Wait For It, the song that Rich just talked about, you have Burr almost kind of unraveling before our eyes, his hatred of Hamilton and his abiding, growing envy and sort of just drivenness to be part of the corridors of power is revealed to us in a sort of rising crescendo of intensity, which among other things leads him from saying, I want to be in the room where it happens, to at the very end of the song, I got to be in the room where it happens. And you almost feel Burr's fateful rendezvous with Hamilton taking shape at this very minute, which of course does in fact ultimately result in the duel and Hamilton's death. But anyway, all of this is taking place in a 5-minute song, incidentally, that's marked Hip Hop Dixieland. So,
We should say something. So, Virginia, there's a banjo that people could hear in that little bit of the chorus. And there's a name we haven't mentioned so far that maybe is the reason for the banjo. You want to tell us about that?
It was Alex Lacamoire, the musician. He said basically he wants to be known as the man that put the banjo into Hamilton on Broadway.
And explain who he is?
He is the
orchestrator.
The orchestrator, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Music director.
And actually, Miranda has said of all the great ideas that Lack had in this show, that's the greatest, the putting the banjo in that song.
So let's hear just a little bit more from that song. We're going to have to go to a break pretty soon, and we may not be able to dive in as deep. But so, Wolfie, just go to the next one.
Meanwhile, Madison is grappling with the fact that not every issue can be settled by committee.
Meanwhile,
Congress is fighting over where to put the capital. It isn't pretty. Then Jefferson approaches with a dinner and invite, and Madison responds with Virginian insight.
Maybe we can solve one problem with another and win a victory for the Southerners. In other words,
oh, ho.
A quid pro quo.
I suppose.
Wouldn't you like to work a little closer to home?
Actually, I would.
Well, I propose the Potomac.
And you'll provide him his votes.
Well, we'll see how it goes.
Let's go.
No.
Okay, so that's you're hearing Jefferson, Madison, and Burr conspire among themselves. You want to like riff on that for a second?
Well, again, that just speaks to the kind of remarkableness of the fact that you have three streams going on in this 1 5-minute song, because just a second later, Burr comes back in again in an almost a kind of soliloquy, and this time with the maximum intensity, reflecting on the fact that he wasn't in the room where it happened and how he's determined to not, you know, be pushed around by his rival and tormentor, Hamilton, in the way. And in fact, later on in the song, as you, I'm sure, remember, Rich, there's even a little taunting quote of wait for it, wait for it. And Hamilton is saying, you don't get anything in life if you wait for it. And he's throwing that up in Burr's face, which is you know, has predictable results. So it's just an ingenious song, and it does quite properly bring the house down.
Well, let's go to a break right now, so we'll have time to recommend some stuff. But apropos of that, Wolfie, maybe you can just play us out with clip four there.
Alexander Hamilton.
What did they say to you to get you to sell New York City down the river?
Alexander Hamilton.
Did Washington know about the dinner? Was there presidential pressure to deliver?
Alexander Hamilton.
Or did you know even then it doesn't matter where you put the U.S. Capitol?
Because we'll have the banks. We're in the same spot.
You got more than you gave.
And I wanted what I got. When you got skin in the game, you stay in the game. But you don't get a win unless you play in the game. Oh, you get love for it, you get hate for it, you get nothing if you wait for it, wait for it, wait.
This is the part of the show where we do the credits for all the people who don't get enough credit for the credit they gave us. This episode was produced by Theodosia McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish is one of 32,000 fish in New York Harbor. The part of Bill Curry was played by George Washington. On Monday, The Scramble is talking about women and far-right nationalist movements, and maybe also about 100 Christmas songs ranked. And now, back to Colin.
All right, it's time to do some recommendations, endorsements, and things like that. Before we do that, I would take note of the fact that Nancy Wilson, the great jazz chanteuse, passed at the age of 81, and she is remarkable. And so if you want to do something else this weekend, you could take out your Spotify or whatever it is you're using and make yourself a little Nancy Wilson playlist. But Rich is the most experienced endorser here. Why don't you get us started?
Sure. The Commission on Cultural Affairs for the City of Hartford, about a month ago or so, maybe a little bit more than that, announced the city's first poet laureate, and it's Frederick Douglass Knowles III. And my endorsement today, as Frederick is starting to make the tours of the city and talk in schools and talk in and read in every venue possible, is to plug his book. Which is Black Rose City. It's the latest one that I stumbled on, and it's actually really brilliant. It's snapshots of urbanism and relationships and the isolation that exists in those spaces, and really worth the read. I think it's available on Amazon.
Very cool. Mr. Metcalf, what do you have for us?
Well, if this isn't too shameless, the great President's College program at the University of Hartford will announce online, that's hartford.edu/presidentscollege, on Tuesday morning, its roster of courses and lectures for the spring semester. And anyone can sign up, and we hope you will. We have a really, truly, I would say, distinguished lineup of events. And so please visit the website and sign up for 3 or 5 courses.
All right. Virginia Wolf, what do you have for us?
I'd like to chat about an art center in Southington. It's called the Arts at Angeloria's. This is a fabulous place. The woman who runs it, she has a rambling Victorian house that when they cut some arts funding where she teaches, she turned it into an art center. The theater is her 2-car garage. She's got this all this land. She's built a huge performance barn, and she is single-handedly running amazing programs and camps for kids and just arts all over the place. So nothing in particular, but the arts at angelorias.com. See what's coming up. It's a charming place to visit or to create.
All right. I want to do a few things that kind of fit in a little bit with our Hamilton theme here today. So first of all, among the musicals that I've seen in the last – probably the other musical I've seen in the last 4 or 5 years that completely blew my mind and has really stayed with me is a musical called Hadestown. I saw it at New York Theater Workshop. It's by kind of alt-folk composer, Anais Mitchell. The staging of it was mind-blowing. It is the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. But it's kind of – I don't know. It's sort of slammed up against – kind of a, I don't know, Depression era hobo trains kind of thing that's happening. Truly remarkable. And the reason I'm mentioning it is it's coming to Broadway. Those of us who saw it at New York Theater Workshop kept going, where is it? It's got to go to Broadway. So it's got to go into the theater that Bruce Springsteen is leaving sometime around April. It really, you absolutely have to do this. And then another thing If you want to maybe sort of find the next big thing, one thing that I've, I think, recommended in the past and participated in the past myself, Goodspeed Musicals does a thing in January where they – it's, I think, sort of the week – right around January 17th, 18th this winter, where for 3 days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, they have people coming in who are workshopping musicals. Quite frequently, the musicals are done in a concert form by – often with people from Hart's tremendous musical theater program. So if you want to sort of maybe, you know, buy low and sell high, you might go and see that. Is there anything else that I desperately have to mention? Just very quickly. So on Monday, we may, as Wolfie was alluding to, talk about our friend Alexandra Petri, a very funny writer for The Washington Post, ranked 100 different Christmas songs in order with Little Drummer Boy in Hell and Good King Wences at the top in Heaven. We may be talking about that. If you have time over the weekend, we're not going to play it right now, but there's a song that nobody knows called The Man with the Bag that – did K-Star do it originally? I don't know. There's a great sort of big band kind of Christmas song that didn't make her list because nobody knows about it. It's a great song. Look it up. The Band with the Bag. All right. So we're going to play out with some music here, and then we're going to ask you once again to support the show. The staff of the show is going to tell you why. It's the last day of fundraising, and the staff of the show is going to tell you why you should support this show. What I decided to do was on the very last day of fundraising, I think it's important once again, the voices of the people who put this show together are the voices that I want you to hear. They're going to explain what it is that we specifically do. And if you donate now, I mean, we do get a little bit more credit for it. And I'm assuming that if you're listening right now, the kind of programming we do actually does mean something to you. So you're going to hear a lot of the different producers. I don't know if I managed to name them all or explain who they are, but a lot of the people who work on the show are going to be explaining to you why you should give.
Centuries from now, they play my freestyle and say this is the brilliance of a black American child, endowed by the streets of the shy proud, known to move in silence but could be loud. The noise of beat girls and boys building to destroy the perception of urban aggression. My life is up aggression, of course, for the oppressors of chorus. My story is the glory of the Lord.
So this is me again. I'm here in the Pledge Drive studio with Golden Globe award winning, or no, nominee actually, Carlos Mejia, the filmmaker. Scott Breedy, the newest producer here at the station. Jonathan McPants, who produces The Nose that you're listening to. Senior producer and troublemaker, Betsy Kaplan. And of course, Wolfie's there running the board right now. So Scott, it's the last day of the Pledge Drive. This is our last chance to talk to them about the Colin McEnroe Show. Say something incredibly inspirational.
When I came here, the idea of coming up with an entire show about color or about toothbrushes just blew my mind. And I still don't understand it, but I'm
starting to do it.
But, you know, I'm sort of like beginning to look at the rundowns and seeing how these things come together. And it's a real lot of work that goes into producing a show about toothbrushes. I mean, Betsy was like practically pulling her hair out coming up with topics. And we brought dogs in. We brought Tucker Ives' dog in to do the show.
Dog's TV.
Yeah, and it was awesome. So the number to call. Can I call a number? Should I say the number?
Do you want to call the number?
No, the number to call is 1-800-584-2788.
It'd be cool if we called it right now and like put them on the line.
Sort of an inception moment.
Yeah.
Should I say you should also go to WNPR.org?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, can I do
they
that?
They like to say ORG, but I say org too because
but then at the end you have to say and thanks. People love that.
Right.
I don't know what that is.
Well, no, but it is a good thing. I mean, because people are going to do this, and it's important to thank them. I mean, the whole thing doesn't work unless we can get people to put up with our nonsense, which means they have to care about a show that we're doing, like The Nose, or a show about brushing teeth or toothbrushes or
towels.
Towels, yeah. And by the way, this whole thing of her pulling out her hair, that's just her process.
After I'm done brushing my teeth.
I pull out my hair.
So, but we do thank you all very much for supporting us this week. And when you do it during our little time here, our little time together, it does kind of counts on the ledger in our favor too. So if you love the show, you love the nose, you love all the people you met through the nose, make that phone call. Wolfie's going to give you the number, the website, and the inspiration.
All right. I think we should all say it together because my theory is that if you can say the number along with us, then you should probably be a member because that means you listen not only to the station in general, but you listen through the fund drive, which really says a lot about you. So let's all do it.
1-800-584-2788.
That was beautiful. Oh, and man. You can go to WNPR.org. You can see lots of thank you items. So you can like go to the grocery store and you'll have your public radio tote bag and you'll lock eyes with someone down the produce aisle who also has a tote bag and a fresh air hat, and you can make eyes at each other and meet someone who clearly has the same wonderful taste in
Try not to
radio.
Shoplift if you're actually using one of our bags.
Don't shoplift with our tote bags. And thank you in advance. That's 1-800-584-2788.